The following podcast is a conversation between my boyfriend Charlie and I about my religious upbringing in the evangelical Christian church and the process I went through leaving that church in my early 20s and my following journey towards non-religion. Hi, my name is Meg, and this is Upspeak, where I talk about women's issues unapologetically while driving in my car. Church I grew up in, there was dancing and singing in a band and the hand raising and being slain in the spirit and laughing, you know, spiritual laughter where, you know, the Holy Spirit, which is a manifestation of God, would fill you and you would start laughing hysterically. Some of these things they would point to, like that these things had happened in the Bible or that there were examples of similar things in the Bible. But basically they believe in you know, being baptized in the Spirit. So like a lot of churches, you know, baptism is a core tenet of many different belief systems. And we did believe in baptism by water as well. But then charismatic Christian churches, they believe in being baptized in the Holy Spirit, which is a different thing, where they pray for you and pray that the Holy Spirit will fill you and that you'll speak in tongues, and which is this like spiritual language that you suddenly start speaking in. And the church I was raised in, they believed all of those things and more. And as far as, you know, children believing that they're going to burn in hell for all of eternity if they don't have Jesus Christ in their heart as their Lord and Savior, yeah, I mean, that's something that I learned at a very, very young age.
What's being slain in the spirit?
Being slain in the spirit is when someone prays for you and puts their hands on you, and then you like fall on the ground in this like trance-like state, and you're overcome by the Spirit of God, and then when you get up, you're transformed.
Have you experienced that?
What do you mean? Have I been slain in the spirit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah? Walk me through that. Walk me through, like, when you were little and you saw that happening to people, what did you think? And then what were your feelings the first time that it happened to you? And then looking back, what do you think about that?
Oh, God. So you may think that something like that is sort of crazy and shocking, and that as a kid it might be scary, or you might think it was strange. But when you're a kid, everything is new and different. And for me, I was exposed to that stuff at such an early age, I don't remember ever thinking it was strange or weird. If you're introduced to something as a kid and told by your parents and everyone you know and love that that's normal, and you see something and then you go, well, what's that? And then your parents explain it to you. Then you go, oh, okay. And then that's just part of your world. Right? So, remember ever having a feeling of it being weird because of how early it was introduced to me and because everyone in my world didn't think it was weird. So I don't remember the first time I saw someone be slain in the spirit or speak in tongues or any of those things at all. And I don't remember the first time it happened to me either, because it always happened.
What do you mean, it always happened?
It was a part of my life for as long as I can remember.
I'm trying to keep my faith. We on a ultralight beam, we on a ultralight beam. This is a God dream, this is a God dream. This is everything. This is everything. Deliver us serenity, deliver us peace, deliver us love, and we know we need it.
You know we need it. How much of it was you doing what you thought you were supposed to do, and how much of it was you experiencing something, period?
I have a really hard time answering that question because the two are inextricably linked for me. Like, doing what I was supposed to do and having my own personal experience, I have a very hard time separating those two things when I think about my childhood. I, looking back, feel I obviously was doing what I was supposed to do. But when I was in it, it felt like it was my experience.
Was there ever a point, and I'm asking you this knowing that you are no longer a part of that community or a part of that belief system, was there ever a point where going through that you felt like this isn't honest, I'm playing along? Or did that happen later?
There were those points, yeah. There were points when, say when I was like speaking in tongues or something, where I would think to myself, I'm just doing what I'm hearing my dad do. Or, you know what I mean? Like, I'm reciting what I hear my dad doing. I'm trying to copy what I'm seeing. And what was interesting about that is that I never felt that I was being dishonest. Or, I'm sorry, I never felt like there was a dishonesty in the system. Or that my parents in some way were being dishonest with me, or that the religion or the belief system was flawed. I automatically felt that something was wrong with me. So I felt that maybe I hadn't been properly baptized in the Spirit, or I thought that I had received the Spirit, but I actually hadn't. Or, I didn't know what I was doing, and I was somehow flawed in the process, as opposed to questioning the whole thing.
I'm trying to keep my faith, but I'm looking for more. Somewhere I can feel safe, and in my holy war, I'm trying to keep my faith.
Why send depression, not blessings? Why, oh why, you do me wrong? You persecute the weak because it makes you feel so strong. Don't have much strength to fight, so I look to the light to make these wrongs turn right. Head up high, I look to the light. Hey, cause I know that you'll make
I remember one time as a teenager, me asking my dad, you know, do you ever think this is all just a hoax? Like, do you ever question it to the point where you just don't have an answer and feel like, what if we are wrong and everybody else is right? And to me, everybody else was like anyone who's not a Christian, because I had a very limited understanding of how extremely varied people's belief systems are. It was like, you are either an evangelical charismatic Christian or you're someone else, who we refer to them as non-believers, which I actually take issue with now, because I think it's just really narcissistic that Christians call anyone who doesn't believe what they believe a non-believer. I don't know. It's like you're either what they are or you're a non of what they are, if that makes sense. Like, there's not like, you know, hundreds of different ways of believing. It's just you're this or you're a non-this. So, I kind of lost the question. I'm sorry. So I remember asking him that, like, what if we're the ones who are wrong? And him maybe entertaining that line of questioning a little bit for a hot minute, but then ultimately kind of saying, like, you just have to have faith. Like, that's what it's about in the end. And there's nothing I can give you. There's nothing tangible I can give you that's going to prove all of this. It's just, you know, it's like the wind. You can't see it. You have to believe that, you know, you can feel it. You can feel its effects, but you can't see it. And you just have to believe in wind.
So when you were 12 and you got that answer, was that answer satisfactory to you?
No. So, you know, when it got to a point where there was a wall in my questioning, I would react by just stopping the questioning and just not stopping the questioning inside of myself. Not stopping the questioning inside of myself, but maybe not questioning that person any longer, you know, because there, you know, with my dad, I felt that there was a certain space where it was okay to question certain things. And then there was another space that was more off limits. And so I would often find myself walking that line and not wanting to cross it.
We on an ultralight beam. We on an ultralight beam. This is a God dream. This is a God dream. This is everything.
Hallelujah.
Everything.
I'm trying to keep my faith.
Yes,
but I'm looking for more. Somewhere I can feel safe. And in my holy world.
After I married Tim, that's when I began to start doubting. That's when I remember having more, I would say, like intellectual conversations than I had ever had before with Tim. And Tim was a reader and very well traveled, and like he's Polish, and he spoke a little bit of, you know, Polish and Russian, and he spoke a little bit of Spanish, and I thought he was, like, you know, kind of worldly and cool, and he would be reading books on, like, Buddhism or things like that. Like, I remember us having a book on Buddhism in our bathroom at one point, and, like, almost being afraid to open it, like, to crack the cover, like, and I thought it was so risque of him that he even owned that book. And some of the conversations we would have would be more, like, about philosophy or about different religions, and he wasn't scared of the questions and the conversation. I was having nightmares. I was, like, waking up at night in sweats about my belief system. I was questioning everything, and it was like a rabbit hole. Like, the more questions that couldn't be answered, the, you know, the deeper I went, the more questions I had, and it was bringing me to a place of almost panic. Like, I felt panicked that perhaps everything I'd always been told wasn't real. And if that was true, then what? And I remember just sitting at our kitchen bar sobbing and saying, what if it's all fake? And he said, what if it is? You know, I don't know. What if it is? And that's, if I had to point to a moment, that would be the moment where there was no turning back.
Speaking of the truth, I'd like to hear it once in a while, and I'll even listen to all your vanity. Utter lies are like butterflies, they just both die in a couple of days. Yeah, show me all your proof, put it right in front of my eyes, and I'll even listen to all your vanity. Yeah. Utter lies are like butterflies, they just both die in a couple of days. And what's in me? And what's in you? We're just bricks on the floor.
You had someone else in your life, though, early on.
Yeah, I did.
Who you loved a lot.
Yeah.
Who was not in that community of faith. Talk about him.
Yeah, my mom's stepdad, who I called my grampy, is the only person... He's the only person who ever told me the truth.
And what was your relationship like with him?
I loved him a lot. He was grumpy and old and smoked a lot of cigarettes. And was agnostic, I think. He dropped out of school really young. He lost the love of his life when he was really young. She died and left him with two kids. And he was a small business owner, and he was really smart and brave and really honest. And he used to tell me I was brainwashed all the time when I was little, and I would try to convert him.
And how would that go?
Not well. It was actually quite a source of stress in my little life that this one person that I loved so much didn't believe all the things that the rest of us did, mm-hmm. including his wife, my grandmother.
And what would he say to you? I mean, what do you remember? I mean, you were little, but what do you remember him saying? What was the connection like, and what would he offer you?
He offered me debate, you know, like, I don't know. My grandpa always used to talk to me like I was an adult, you know, like as though I had something insightful to say. And I mean, really, what does an 8-year-old have? I mean, like, what does an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old have to say that's so insightful? But he had that kind of relationship with my sister Lauren and I, where he would take us places and talk to us over, like, I just have really clear memories of us standing on his back porch and, like, eating watermelon slices and spitting the seeds over the railing and talking, or, like, having breakfast together, having, like, oatmeal or something, like, piled high with brown sugar, and us having conversations. There was a lot of talking. There was a lot of conversations. I used to ask him a lot of questions. I found him to be incredibly fascinating as a human being, even from a very young age. And I think clearly one of the most fascinating things about him to me, whether I knew it then or not, is that he was just the only one. He was the only one who didn't buy in. And so I was afraid for him. You know, I was afraid he was old, and I was afraid he was going to die and go to hell is really what it came down to. And it was like this steely determination of an 8-year-old trying to save the soul of her beloved grandfather, and him just being very unconcerned with that and laughing me off as a product of, you know, my parents' ridiculousness.
Do you think that he maybe planted a seed?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think he did. And there was something really honest about him that I connected with. And I felt like he was always going to tell me the truth. And it was disturbing to me that his truth was not what everyone else was telling me. But I couldn't fathom him lying to me either. Like, I know he would never lie to me. But he died when I was 17. I was a senior in high school when he passed away. And I was still very much rooted in my belief system when he passed.
So that being said, when he died, being rooted in your belief system, did you believe that this person that you loved and cared about so deeply was going to be tortured forever in a lake of fire?
Yeah.
You did?
Kind of. I mean, I don't know. My grandma feels that he came to peace with Christ before he died, but I wasn't there.
Do you believe that?
No, I don't. I think he probably wanted her to have peace.
Honest words are like August 3rd, they just both come maybe once in a year. And keeping your opinions to a quiet little hush, it's like brushing your teeth with a razor and shaving with a toothbrush. Just leaves your heart room for exploding all over me. And then it gets to you. You don't have to wait for me, 'cause I'm already yours. Yeah, tell me about your life.
when did you decide to take the only thing that you knew, which was this Christian life, and decide that that's not what you wanted for yourself anymore?
It started to happen, like I said, when I was married, but it didn't culminate until after I left my husband. And sadly, I do think that I put a lot of my internal struggle on him and connected the two, because he was a minister and because he worked for my father. And so a lot of my rebellion against the church and against my father ended up being rebellion against him, because I felt like he was part of this patriarchal system that was holding me down, and I had married him at 19 years old. And you know, anything I felt I was missing out on in life, or that I hadn't gotten to experience, or any truth that was out there that wasn't known to me, it was hidden because of them, you know? Mm-hmm. And so when I started just like playing hooky on church, you know, like sitting in the parking lot listening to This American Life, which happened to be on Sunday mornings at just about the same time that my dad would start speaking. So, you know, the services, like, maybe it would start at, like, 9. He would have two services, like, one at 9 o'clock, one at 11 o'clock. And, like, there would be, like, a worship service, and then there would be announcements, and then there would be almost, like, a 30-minute-ish sermon. And I would sit in my car, and I will never forget the feeling of just watching the clock and kind of being like, oh, I should go in right now. Like on the edge of my seat in my car in the church parking lot being like, oh, I should go in right now. I should go in. Just one more minute of the show. Just one more minute of This American Life. And then going in with my coffee and sitting in the back or sitting in the front row and just kind of, you know, sucking it up until the end of the service. And I, you know, and then it went from that. It went from me coming late all the time to me then skipping some of the time, and then me skipping all of the time. And then when I left my husband, we showed up for church the next week, and my father made an announcement to the whole congregation that we were separating. And I think they maybe prayed for us or something like that, the whole church, you know, all like 400 people or something. And we were standing up there in front of everyone. And afterwards, person after person was coming up to me, sort of asking me questions or shocked or confused. And I felt that I had to console them or explain myself to them. And I don't know that I went back after that. I think that was a really scarring service for me. I mean, I felt like I had to defend myself, and I felt embarrassed, and I felt ashamed, and my father fired my ex-husband shortly thereafter, and it took us almost 2 years to finalize our divorce, but we lived apart for about 2 years.
Standing in front of a church of 400 people with your father announcing to them that you and your husband are no longer going to be together sounds horrifying.
Uh-huh.
What was the purpose of that?
Well, I think in that culture, you know, there was a huge value on transparency when it came to sin. And I was married to someone who was a core leader in that church organization. And a lot of people, I think, looked up to us. They definitely looked up to Tim. You know, he would be the one preaching if my dad was out of town. He was the associate pastor. So he did a lot of counseling with people who were going through difficult times. He did weddings and funerals and helped run the organization. And so in that setting, there's, like I said, a big value on transparency when it comes to sin and to maybe difficult times that people are going through. And so with him being a leader, they wanted to say to everybody, like, hey, like, it was almost like, you know, like if a famous person is separating from their spouse or something, they'll put out like a media statement. It was like our media statement.
What was the sin?
Divorce is a sin. They I don't think that they would have said they were pointing out our sins. I think that the idea was that we're going to sort of gather around this couple who's going through a difficult time and, like, support them through it. But I just don't know that they have a grid for how unsupportive it is to stand someone up in front of hundreds of people and say, and air their dirty laundry. I don't, like, there's just nothing supportive about that process, you know?
Yeah, right.
But I don't think that it came from a place of like, oh, let's point out this sin. I mean, in my most cynical moments, I might feel that there was a bit of intrigue. You know, this pastor and his wife, she left him and they're going through the separation. And maybe there was a bit of, you know, it was very salacious and interesting. And maybe that's why it got attention. But that's in my you know, more critical moments. In my more peaceful, fair moments, I feel like that's the reality they lived in, which just, this is how we support people when they're going through something. We gather around them, we pray for them, we lend them our support, and this is what that looks like.
Did it feel supportive?
Well, no, I mean, clearly I never went back.
I don't wanna be your hero. I don't wanna be a big man. I just wanna fight with everyone else. Your masquerade. I don't wanna be a part of your parade. Everyone deserves a chance to walk with everyone else.
A lot of people might say, what's, you know, who cares? What's the big deal? I mean, if this environment makes people feel better, if people find comfort in it, what's the harm? Do you feel that you were harmed?
It's hard for me to answer that question because I do feel that the harm was extensive and pervasive, and it's difficult for me to articulate it. But it affected every area of my universe. I mean, my relationships, like I said, my relationships with men, my self-worth, how I viewed myself as secondary, you know. In the Bible, there's a lot of talk around men being leaders, men being in charge and paving the way and being the initiators and being the final say. And women are responders, women are followers, women are helpmates. You know, and it's like this whole thing of they're equal, they're just different. But, you know, I mean, are master and slave equal? One holds a position of power, responsibility, strength. The other is supposed to support that. So finding my own voice, feeling validated in my opinions outside of the covering of a man, as they say, like the spiritual covering, was difficult and initially just showed up like rebellion, like me being angry. I mean, I remember my first husband, when I first started going to therapy, I had been married for maybe a year. So I was 21. I'd never been to therapy before, and I don't think anyone in my family had ever been to therapy before. That was not something we were super culturally connected to, like getting help in that way. And I remember my husband making my appointment for me, which I don't know why he would have been the one to schedule it, but I remember him making the appointment, and when they asked him, why is she coming to see us, he said, she's really angry. And I remember thinking at the time, that's not why I'm coming. I'm really depressed. I'm really sad. And I thought it was really interesting that his perception was that I was angry. And looking back, I absolutely was angry. I was pissed off. And I couldn't figure out why or at whom, but I was really mad. And so I wanted to push back against anything that made me feel pushed down or silenced. And me having a loud voice, me having a persistent voice, was frustrating, I think, to the people around me, and particularly so to the men around me. Coming back from my honeymoon, and I had dyed my hair red, like cherry red, and I had gotten a tiny little nose ring, like a little stud. You know, I was 19. I had just turned 20. I think I turned 20 the month after I got married. We'd gone away to California for a couple of weeks after the wedding, and my mom picked us up at the airport, and shortly thereafter, my father called me and said that my mom had been crying and was very upset that I had dyed my hair and pierced my nose, and he asked me to take it out. And I was really upset, but I did it. I dyed my hair back and I took my nose ring out. I threw it away. And then a couple of years later, as I was starting to question my religious faith and on my way out of my marriage as well, things like that event haunted me, and I felt angry about it. I felt angry that anyone had the authority to tell me what to do in that way. You know, this is not someone I was working for. This was my dad, and I was a married woman. And, you know, I resented that. I resented that I wanted to express myself in ways that my parents didn't understand. And I think I resented myself for bowing to it ultimately. And so in my late 20s and my early 30s, there's just been so much focus for me on creating healthy boundaries and learning how to have a relationship with a man that's healthy, a relationship with relationships with women, relationships with authority figures, and as cliche as it is, a relationship with myself that's healthy and honest and true, and recognizing that my truth is not less than anyone else's. My experiences, my path, my stories, my history, my perceptions of how people treated me, what happened, who I am, all of that, it's all valid. It's all real to me, and it's all just as worthy of expression as anyone else's story. I didn't have anyone when I was in my early 20s leaving the church and leaving my marriage who said, I got you, girl. I understand you. You're going to be okay. I didn't have that. I didn't have someone on the other side saying, this is going to suck for you for a long time before it doesn't, but it's necessary for you to do this. You're on the right path. Keep going. I didn't have anyone saying that. And for me, it meant that I went through serious depression and my anxiety at times felt like it was going to swallow me whole. My panic disorder, all of these things that came out of these unhealthy ways of being that I grew up in, as well as, you know, just how I processed those things, because I'm, you know, I'm a unique person with a unique set of emotions and chemicals and brain chemistry and all of that. And the way that I processed my experiences created a lot of stress and anxiety within me that I had to work through. And I didn't have that person. I didn't have that person holding a lantern in front of me. And I want to be that person for someone else.
What's the matter? You hurt yourself. Open your eyes and there was someone else. Now I've got you in the undertow. Now I've got you in the undertow. Why you wanna blame me for your troubles? You better.
The harm for me being raised in that very literal interpretation of the scripture is that it messed up the way I saw myself and myself in relation to the world. And I have had to sort through that piece by piece, like trying to find a needle in a haystack. For the better part of the past 10 years, hundreds of yoga sessions, therapy sessions, medication, retreats, personal development, weekends, you know, so many conversations with people, so many wrong turns as a result of my wrong thinking about myself and others. It's been a real struggle. It's been a real journey to find sanity, to find peace, to recognize everyone's different. It's all okay. Acceptance, empathy, love trumps all. I am worthy. I am valuable. And not just because I toe the line or believe the things I was brought up to believe. I'm valuable, I'm worthy, because I am. Because we all are. And that's it. And that's why I'm sharing.
You hurt yourself, open your eyes and there was someone else. Now I've got you in the undertow.
Have siblings?
I I do. I'm the oldest of four.
You have, you know, an extended family. Everyone is part of this belief system.
Yep.
Do you think that they all think that you're bound for eternal damnation and hell?
I don't. I don't think that they think that.
What do you think they think?
I think they probably feel bad for me to some degree because I'm not walking the path that they're walking, that they find a lot of joy and fulfillment within. So they probably feel a little bit bad for me, and then they probably feel a lot of love for me and like a desire for me to find happiness, which BT dubs means find God again. And there might not be a huge grid for understanding the many beautiful ways a human being can find happiness in this life outside of a, you know, very particular religion. But yeah, I don't think that they think that. I think that there may or may not be a belief system that once you've been saved, you're always saved. So in which case I'd be in still, regardless of what I'm currently doing. But there's also a term in the church, backslidden, which is when a Christian stops being a Christian for a while and lives a sinful life. And they probably believe that I'm backslidden. I'm sure they pray for me a lot because they love me. And that's what you do when someone you love is backslidden.
Done with you in time once had, passed between my hands. The memories we can feel them fade, like circles in the sand. A thousand thoughts, a thousand dreams, lost within the day. A thousand ways for souls to touch the things that we should say, the things that we should say.
It's also worth mentioning that you went through a whole like yoga phase, which is which is really interesting. So talk about how sort of your journey of how you got to where you are now and where you are now.
Yeah, I look at yoga as like my transition phase because it was really hard for me to go cold turkey from the belief system that I was brought up in that was very much steeped in community and the afterlife and this relationship, this personal relationship that you could have with this being in the sky, and then suddenly just, you know, not have any of those things. It felt like a void to me. And so there was a short period of pretty deep rebellion against all that I was raised within when I was like 23, 24, 25. Just kind of later than most people go through.
That's not so short.
Okay, so there were a couple of years there where I was definitely drinking a lot, experimenting with drugs, and dating a lot of different people, and exploring my sexuality and my belief systems in a way that I had not done as a teenager or during kind of college years like some kids do. For me, it was later. For me, it was like post my first marriage.
Was there a sense for you of waiting sort of for some horrible thing to happen? I mean, you'd been raised for 20 years to think that, you know, if you exposed yourself to these things and this type of person and this environment, then, oh my gosh, all these horrible things. Were you waiting for some horrible things to happen, or was it more proof that none of that was true? Was there still part of you that expected something awful to occur because of what you were doing? Or was this, or by the time you were doing all of it, were you convinced that all those things that you were told were bullshit?
when I was doing it, I was not convinced that all the things I had been told were bullshit, but I was very intent on poking holes in all of them. So I wanted to do all of the things that I quote unquote should not be doing, and see what happened. And I wanted to be drunk. I'd never, you know, when I left my first husband, I had never been drunk. You know, I was just had been only with one person. And with one man, and I was, you know, had obviously like never tried drugs or anything like that, never smoked a joint. I, with these people that I was hanging out with, I was very much the innocent, but you know, it didn't take long for me to corrupt myself quite thoroughly. And, I wanted to try all the things. I was open to everything, actually. And it took me a few years to find the balance in that, like to realize that my complete abandon and sort of like I ran wildly into the wind and just said yes to everything was just as unhealthy as how I was raised and what I came from, and was destroying me in a different way. Sure. And so I had to come around to a personal journey of self-love that did not revolve around an understanding of God and of Christianity. And yoga was the bridge. So I met a yoga teacher. I fell in love with a yoga teacher. And so then I started going to yoga. And then I became a yoga teacher. And then for much of the following 8 years was in the yoga community, teaching at various studios, managing one of the largest studios in the Midwest, actually, until very recently. And yoga was a huge, huge part of my life. Yoga was my religion.
Was?
Yes, was.
And what happened?
I began to become aware of the fact that yoga was another drug for me. Yoga was another illusion. And though it was a somewhat healthy pastime, you know, for me for many years and taught me a lot about self-love, taking care of myself physically and mentally and emotionally, and I met a lot of really wonderful people in the yoga world, I also felt that I had to continue to buy into some things that still felt really unreal and magical, and that didn't feel honest.
First born, carry promise of the old born. You're the same, but some not deep. They're the burdens of the line. It breaks in, and you never see it come. Seems like every other morning, like a secret you can't tell.
General, I mean, I know you can only speak for yourself, but in general, do you think that there's a slingshot effect, which is the harder you hold back a person, the harder they recoil in a rebellion?
It was definitely the case with me.
Do you think that's the case? Do you think that that's a good rule of thumb? Do you think that that's important? I mean, now you're a mom.
Yeah.
I mean, what is your... I mean, you're obviously a mom of a very young child, but I mean, when your son starts getting to the point where he is adolescent and a teenager, how much are you going to take to heart the idea that restriction now equals rebellion later? Do you think that's a good rule of thumb or what?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know. I'm not like a psychologist or a sociologist or whatever, but I think it's a good rule of thumb. I went pretty far in the opposite direction and had to find the balance. And for me, that was just a natural process. I don't know that it could have happened any other way for me. I think I kind of had to just dive in, like close my eyes and jump, and then figure out how to swim. And that's how I tend to do things in life anyhow. It's just, you know, say yes now, figure it out later. But yeah, I mean, with my son, I feel like I am super cognizant of wanting to have minimal rules. Like, I mean, beyond kindness always and forever, is, you know, a hard thing to teach a child, you know, sharing and all that comes with it and how to speak. I don't want there to be a ton of rules. I don't want to create a structure that he has to rebel against. And I mean, listen, I've set myself up for it. I think like my son already is like a mini little Trump supporter who just told me the other day that he wants me to go to church. His father takes him to church. And obviously he's a big fan of his grandparents, who also take him to church occasionally and talk to him about God. And he told me the other day he wants me to come to church with him so I can learn about God. And he really wants me to have God in my mind. And it's a tough pill to swallow. And he's only 5.
When you see your 5-year-old son buying into the thing that you've said caused you so much harm, where does that take you?
It terrifies me. But I imagine that's much how my parents felt when they saw me rebelling. You know, I mean, he's 5, he's not rebelling, but when my parents see me do things that are outside their belief structure, it's probably terrifying to them. I think that's parenthood, is loving these humans, you know, so much. And I'm gonna cry. Loving these humans so much, you don't want them to feel or experience the same pain that you had to feel and experience. But then you have to remind yourself that protecting them from that creates its own kind of pain.
And you can't teach your kids what to think. You can just teach them how to think.
Totally, yeah. And so I feel myself wanting to be reactive when he says those things to me. And then I feel that my journey is to listen and to have an open heart and to recognize that he's 5. I mean, this is what he likes at 5. Who knows what he'll like at 6 or 7 or 8. And all along the way, I have to be open to what his reality is and what his experience is. And I have to guide him in a very loose and loving way and not impose upon him all of what I would love to impose upon him if I thought it would actually work. But I just don't think that's good parenting.
And you get carried away. Carried away, carried away, carried away. Carried away, carried away, carried away.
Where I'm at now, to go back to your, to sort of the other part of your last question, which is where am I now? I think I'm at the most honest place I've been at, you know, at 35 years old. I feel like I'm finally at a place where I can, you know, say that there's no proof that God exists, and I just really, you know, I'm only going to believe things that are rooted in proof and that have proof and that are rooted in science. And that is a sane place to live and to be. And I want to be sane. I want to be honest. I want to be intellectually honest and sane. And in order for me to do that, I have to say there's no proof that, you know, a magical being exists in the sky any greater than there's proof, you know, that there's unicorns or dragons. And let me tell you, I'm a huge fan of dragons and wish to God that they were real, but they're not, and my wishing doesn't change that. So I'd say it's been a long way around, but where I'm at now feels honest. It feels authentic to me. It feels real, and I feel safe in that reality. Like, I feel confident in that place.
You shared with me a story where someone said to you, "Oh, Megan, you know, you're a very spiritual person," and you said, "No, I'm not." And they said, "Oh, well, but you're a good person.
You have values."
But you have values. And you said, "Well, yeah, I don't believe in any supernatural, and I'm not spiritual at all." And they made it very clear that they still thought that you were good.
As if the two can't exist together, right? Like,
do you struggle with that? Do you find that there's in your life? I mean, I know there, of course, there is in the world where people think, you know, there's this huge stigma against, you know, saying you're an atheist or saying you don't believe in God. And oh my gosh, where does your moral compass come from? How do you know right from wrong? And why don't you just rape everyone you see?
Right.
But do you find that's something that you have to deal with, of people thinking that there must be, you must be some lost lamb? I mean, not just from an, I mean, this wasn't someone who was an evangelical.
No.
This was someone who was, you know, educated.
Yep.
Liberal.
Liberal, yep.
Who was, you know, surprised that you weren't religious, and but still had a sense of morality.
Yeah, I mean, listen, atheism is one of those things that I feel like is in the final frontier. Like, it's just, we got to get rid of the stigma around those who don't believe in God. I mean, it's ridiculous. This is 2017. Like, you know, most of the world doesn't believe these things, but we act as though, especially in our country, we act as though it's just shocking and mortifying. And even my friends who don't believe in God have a very hard time saying that they don't. Like, I have a really good friend who's like, "I'm basically an atheist, but like, I'm just not ready to say it yet." And I really relate to that because I've felt that way. But I just think it's dishonest. I just think it's a dishonest way of being. It's like the people who voted for Trump but are like, "But I'm not really, I don't really support him. I don't believe, you know, half the things he says, and I don't think he's a great guy, and I'm not," you know, it's like, "But yeah, right, but you still voted for him." So like, you don't get the luxury of pretending like you didn't participate in that. You did. You know, just as much as the person who's that, like, alt-right crazy, you both participated, you both hit that button, you know, like, so I feel like there has to be a moment where you level set with yourself and say, like, this is just not real. And, like, what you said earlier about something that you need to learn early as a child is the difference between real and make-believe. And that is not something I learned as a child, because a lot of the things that I were taught that were real were actually make-believe. And so it's very confusing. As a young adult, I had to sift through real and make-believe in a way that really a four-year-old should have already sorted. You know, angels and demons and heaven and hell and pearly gates and fiery darkness and Noah's Ark and Adam and Eve and the apple and the Garden of Eden. I mean, on and on and on. And like, real and make-believe just were not things I was firmly rooted in, even when I was 25 years old, I would say.
Right. How has your transition from deeply rooted in the church to semi-rooted in the church to deeply rooted in yoga to now being non-religious affected your relationships with the people that you have contact with that are still in that first phase, which is deeply rooted in the church, which is mostly your family?
How has it affected my relationship with the people that I love who are still rooted in that faith? The short answer is deeply. You know, it's hard to have meaningful connection on a daily or weekly basis with individuals whose entire belief system is so drastically different than your own. You know, people tend to hang out with people who are like them in some way, shape, or form. And for my own sanity, I've definitely had to create a support network of individuals who believe similar things to what I believe now, so that I don't feel crazy and I don't feel like an outsider and I don't feel like, you know, I'm constantly questioning what I believe. So it affects, you create a different type of relationship where you find common ground. So the kids are really helpful, and my sister has two beautiful children, and my son, you know, holidays and things like that become really centered around the children and connecting with the kids and experiencing the holidays through their eyes. And that's something that we can all come together on, because, you know, my siblings and my parents love the kids more than anything, and we all feel that way. So you try to find the things you can agree with. Like, we have a pretty strict, like, no politics, no religion rule when it comes to us all being together. And oh God, I would say half the time we abide by that, and then the other half of the time someone says something and then it spurs some sort of drama. But I mean, I think that's family in general, which is why there's so many jokes about Thanksgiving dinners and the awkwardness and the difficulty that can come out of that with disagreements amongst family members. But you just find a different thing to connect on. And I think the kids are that thing, and there are certain topics we have to avoid, but it definitely affects the relationship. And in the beginning, it affected the relationship just in that I was very bitter and I was very angry about how I was raised and how it was affecting me as an adult. And so I had to do a lot of healing on a personal level to move past my anger. I had to do a lot of digging, and I used yoga and therapy as a way to dig, you know, and to get to a place of being able to accept my whole self. And like, a huge piece of my healing has been learning to accept and embrace how I was raised as part of me rather than rejecting it. Because it has a splintering effect on how you view yourself, you know, like, well, for the first 24 years of my life, I was a crazy person, and now I'm sane. Like, that, you just can't believe that way about yourself, because then everything that happened to you in those first 24 years is somehow tainted, you know? So at least for me, that just wasn't going to work. I have to come to a place where I recognize that everything I've gone through in my life has brought me to this point. Everything I've gone through, you know, up, down, and around, has affected me in some way that has landed me here and has become a part of who I am and how I now respond to the world around me. And so when I talk now about whether it be politics or religion or parenting or whatever, I have young women mostly, or women who are in their 20s and 30s, who will reach out to me and say, thank you for saying those things. I too was raised in a very religious environment, and I come up against these same struggles. And you know, like, I realize that my upbringing gives me a place at the table in conversation with others that I wouldn't have. And it's a table I want to be seated at. Upspeak is produced by myself, Megan Witt, and Chaz Brayman. Our theme music is Dreams by the band Taken by Trees. Additional music in this episode in play order: Ultralight Beam by Kanye West, Butterflies by David Garza, Hero by Family of the Year, Undertow by Warpaint, Things That We Should Say by Future of Forestry, Teach Me to Know by The Lone Bellow, and Seasons Waiting on You by Future Islands. If you didn't get all that, don't worry. It will all be listed in this week's episode description. Please like, subscribe, rate, write a review on iTunes, and share. It really does help. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.
It's hard for me to ask questions that don't just come across as being condescending and ridiculous, sounding like a, you know, it's legitimately hard. Do you want me to? Because you're obviously making a really, really concerted attempt to be measured and respectful in this conversation.
But that's not because I'm measured and respectful as a person. It's really not. It's just that I am extremely cognizant of my natural instinct to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I want to be as fair as possible. I mean, listen, I don't believe any of this shit anymore. So there's that. But keep going. I mean, we can edit out what we need to.